and patients who'd taken it for trivial problems began dying. Radium causes mutations that can turn into cancer, and at high doses, it can burn the skin off a person's body. But it also kills cancer cells. Hopkins had been using radium to treat cervical cancer since the early 1900s, when a surgeon named Howard Kelly visited Marie and Pierre Curie, the couple in France who'd discovered radium and its ability to destroy cancer cells. Without realizing the danger of contact with radium, Kelly brought some back to the United States in his pockets and regularly traveled the world collecting more. By the 1940s, several studies, one of them conducted by Howard Jones, Henrietta's physician, showed that radium was safer and more effective than surgery for treating invasive cervical cancer. The morning of Henrietta's first treatment, a taxi driver picked up a doctor's bag filled with thin glass tubes of radium from a clinic across town. The tubes were tucked into individual slots inside small canvas pouches hand-sewn by a local Baltimore woman. The pouches were called Brack Plaques, after the Hopkins doctor who invented them and oversaw Henrietta's radium treatment. He would later die of cancer, most likely caused by his regular exposure to radium, as would a resident who traveled with Kelly and also transported radium in his pockets. One nurse placed the Brack Plaques on a stainless steel tray. Another wheeled Henrietta into the small, colored-only operating room on the second floor, with stainless steel tables, huge glaring lights, and an all-white medical staff dressed in white gowns, hats, masks, and gloves. With Henrietta unconscious on the operating table in the center of the room, her feet in stirrups, the surgeon on duty, Dr. Lawrence Wharton Jr., sat on a stool between her legs. He peered inside Henrietta, dilated her cervix, and prepared to treat her tumor. But first, though no one had told Henrietta that Talinde was collecting samples or asked if she wanted to be a donor, Wharton picked up a sharp knife and shaved two dime-sized pieces of tissue from Henrietta's cervix, one from her tumor and one from the healthy cervical tissue nearby. Then he placed the samples in a glass dish. Wharton slipped a tube filled with radium inside Henrietta's cervix and sewed it in place. He sewed a plaque filled with radium to the outer surface of her cervix and packed another plaque against it. He slid several rolls of gauze inside her vagina to help keep the radium in place, then threaded a catheter into her bladder so she could urinate without disturbing the treatment. When Wharton finished, a nurse wheeled Henrietta back into the ward, and Wharton wrote in her chart. The patient tolerated the procedure well and left the operating room in good condition. On a separate page, he wrote, Henrietta lacks biopsy of cervical tissue. Tissue given to Dr. George Guy. A resident took the dish with the samples to Guy's lab, as he'd done many times before. Guy still got excited at moments like this, but everyone else in his lab saw Henrietta's sample as something tedious, the latest of what felt like countless samples that scientists and lab technicians had been trying and failing to grow for years. They were sure Henrietta's cells would die, just like all the others. Chapter 4. The Birth of Hela. 1951. Guy's 21-year-old assistant, Mary Kupacek, sat eating a tuna salad sandwich at a long stone culture bench that doubled as a break table. She and Margaret and the other women in the Guy lab spent countless hours there, all in nearly identical cat-eye glasses with fat dark frames and thick lenses, their hair pulled back in tight buns. At first glance, the room could have been an industrial kitchen. There were gallon-sized tin coffee cans full of utensils and glassware, powdered creamer, sugar, spoons, and soda bottles on the table, huge metal freezers lining one wall, and deep sinks Guy made by hand using stones he collected from a nearby quarry. But the teapot sat next to a Bunsen burner, and the freezers were filled with blood, placentas, tumor samples, and dead mice, plus at least one duck Guy kept frozen in the lab for more than 20 years after a hunting trip, since it wouldn't fit in his freezer at home. Guy had lined one wall with cages full of squealing rabbits, rats, and guinea pigs. On one side of the table where Mary sat eating her lunch, he'd built shelves holding cages full of mice, their bodies filled with tumors. Mary always stared at them while she ate, just as she was doing when Guy walked into the lab carrying the pieces of Henrietta's cervix. "I'm putting a new sample in your cubicle," he told her. Mary pretended not to notice. "Not again," she thought, and kept eating her sandwich. "It can wait till I'm done." Mary knew she shouldn't wait. Every moment those cells sat in the dish made it more likely they'd die. But she was tired of cell culture, tired of meticulously cutting away dead tissue like gristle from a steak, tired of having cells die after hours of work. "Why bother?" she thought. Guy hired Mary for her hands. She was fresh out of college with a physiology degree when her advisor sent her for an interview. Guy asked Mary to pick up a pen from the table and write a few sentences. "Now pick up that knife," he said. "Cut this piece of paper. Twirl this pipette." Mary didn't realize until months later that he'd been studying her hands, checking their dexterity and strength to see how they'd stand up to hours of delicate cutting, scraping, tweezing, and pipetting. By the time Henrietta walked into Hopkins, Mary was handling most of the tissue samples that came through the door, and so far, all samples from Talin's patients had died. At that point, there were many obstacles to growing cells successfully. For starters, no one knew exactly what nutrients they needed to survive or how best to supply them. Many researchers, including the guys, had been trying for years to develop the perfect culture medium, the liquid used for feeding cells. The recipes for Guy culture medium evolved constantly as George and Margaret added and removed ingredients, searching for the perfect balance. But they all sounded like witches' brews, the plasma of chickens, puree of calf fetuses, special salts, and blood from human umbilical cords. George had rigged a bell and cable from the window of his lab across a courtyard to the Hopkins maternity ward, so nurses could ring any time a baby was born, and Margaret or Mary would run over and collect umbilical cord blood. The other ingredients weren't so easy to come by. George visited local slaughterhouses at least once a week to collect cow fetuses and chicken blood. He'd drive there in his rusted-out old Chevy, its left fender flapping against the pavement, shooting sparks. Well before dawn, in a run-down wooden building with a sawdust floor and wide gaps in the walls, Guy would grab a screaming chicken by the legs, yank it upside down from its cage, and wrestle it to its back on a butcher block. He'd hold its feet with one hand and pin its neck motionless to the wood with his elbow. With his free hand, he'd squirt the bird's chest with alcohol and plunge a syringe needle into the chicken's heart to draw blood. Then he'd stand the bird upright, saying, "Sorry, old fella," and put it back in its cage. Every once in a while, when a chicken dropped dead from the stress, George took it home so Margaret could fry it for dinner. Like many procedures in their lab, the Guy chicken bleeding technique was Margaret's creation. She worked out the method step by step, taught it to George, and wrote detailed instructions for the many other researchers who wanted to learn it. Finding the perfect medium was an ongoing experiment. But the biggest problem facing cell culture was contamination. Bacteria and a host of other microorganisms could find their way into cultures from people's unwashed hands, their breath, and dust particles floating through the air, and destroy them. But Margaret had been trained as a surgical nurse, which meant sterility was her specialty. It was key to preventing deadly infections in patients in the operating room. Many would later say that Margaret's surgical training was the only reason the Guy lab was able to grow cells at all. Most culturists, like George, were biologists. They knew nothing about preventing contamination. Margaret taught George everything he knew about keeping cultures sterile, and she did the same with every technician, grad student, and scientist who came to work or study in the lab. She hired a local woman named Minnie, whose sole job was washing the laboratory glassware using the only product Margaret would allow, Gold Dust Twins soap. Margaret was so serious about that soap, when she heard a rumor that the company might go out of business, she bought an entire boxcar full of it. Margaret patrolled the lab, arms crossed, and leaned over Minnie's shoulder as she worked, towering nearly a foot above her. If Margaret ever smiled, no one could have seen it through her ever-present surgical mask. She inspected all the glassware for spots or smudges, and when she found them, which was often, she'd scream, "Minnie!" so loud that Mary cringed. Mary followed Margaret's sterilizing rules meticulously to avoid her wrath. After finishing her lunch, and before touching Henrietta's sample, Mary covered herself with a clean white gown, surgical cap, and mask, and then walked to her cubicle, one of four airtight rooms George had built by hand in the center of the lab. The cubicles were small, only 5 feet in any direction, with doors that sealed like a freezer's to prevent contaminated air from getting inside. Mary turned on the sterilizing system and watched from outside as her cubicle filled with hot steam to kill anything that might damage the cells. When the steam cleared, she stepped inside and sealed the door behind her, then hosed the cubicle's cement floor with water and scoured her workbench with alcohol. The air inside was filtered and piped in through a vent on the ceiling. Once she'd sterilized the cubicle, she lit a Bunsen burner and used its flame to sterilize test tubes and a used scalpel blade, since the Guy lab couldn't afford new ones for each sample. Only then did she pick up the pieces of Henrietta's cervix, forceps in one hand, scalpel in the other, and carefully slice them into 1 millimeter squares. She sucked each square into a pipette and dropped them one at a time onto chicken blood clots she'd placed at the bottom of dozens of test tubes. She covered each clot with several drops of culture medium, plugged the tubes with rubber stoppers, and labeled each one as she'd labeled most cultures they grew, using the first two letters of the patient's first and last names. After writing HeLa for Henrietta and Lax in big black letters on the side of each tube, Mary carried them to the incubator room that Guy had built, just like he'd built everything else in the lab, by hand and mostly from junkyard scraps, a skill he'd learned from a lifetime of making do with nothing. George Guy was born in 1899 and raised on a Pittsburgh hillside overlooking a steel mill. Soot from the smokestacks made his parents' small white house look like it had been permanently charred by fire and left the afternoon sky dark. His mother worked the garden and fed her family from nothing but the food she raised. As a child, George dug a small coal mine in the hill behind his parents' house. He'd crawl through the damp tunnel each morning with a pick, filling buckets for his family and neighbors so they could keep their houses warm and stoves burning. Guy paid his way through a biology degree at the University of Pittsburgh by working as a carpenter and mason, and he could make nearly anything for cheap or free. During his second year in medical school, he rigged a microscope with a time-lapse motion picture camera to capture live cells on film. It was a Frankensteinish mishmash of microscope parts, glass, and 16-millimeter camera equipment from who knows where, plus metal scraps and old motors from Shapiro's junkyard. He built it in a hole he'd blasted in the foundation of Hopkins, right below the morgue. its base entirely underground and surrounded by a thick wall of cork to keep it from jiggling when streetcars passed. At night, a Lithuanian lab assistant slept next to the camera on a cot, listening to its constant tick, making sure it stayed stable through the night, waking every hour to refocus it. With that camera, Guy and his mentor, Warren Lewis, filmed the growth of cells, a process so slow, like the growth of a flower, the naked eye couldn't see it. They played the film at high speed so they could watch cell division on the screen in one smooth motion, like a story unfolding in a flip book. It took Guy 8 years to get through medical school, because he kept dropping out to work construction and save for another year's tuition. After he graduated, he and Margaret built their first lab in a janitor's quarters at Hopkins. They spent weeks wiring, painting, plumbing, building counters and cabinets, paying for much of it with their own money. Margaret was cautious and stable, the backbone of the lab. George was an enormous, mischievous, grown-up kid. At work, he was dapper, but at home, he lived in flannels, khakis, and suspenders. He moved boulders around his yard on weekends, ate 12 ears of corn in one sitting, and kept barrels full of oysters in his garage so he could shuck and eat them anytime he wanted. He had the body of a retired linebacker, 6 feet 4 inches tall and 215 pounds, his back unnaturally stiff and upright from having his spine fused so he'd stop throwing it out. When his basement winemaking factory exploded on a Sunday, sending a flood of sparkling burgundy through his garage and into the street, Guy just washed the wine into a storm drain, waving at his neighbors as they walked to church. Guy was a reckless visionary, spontaneous, quick to start dozens of projects at once, filling the lab and his basement at home with half-built machines, partial discoveries, and piles of junkyard scraps only he could imagine using in a lab. Whenever an idea hit him, he sat wherever he was, at his desk, kitchen table, a bar, or behind the wheel of his car, gnawing on his ever-present cigar and scribbling diagrams on napkins or the backs of torn-off bottle labels. That's how he came up with the roller tube culturing technique, his most important invention. It involved a large wooden roller drum, a cylinder with holes for special test tubes called roller tubes. The drum, which Guy called the whirligig, turned like a cement mixer 24 hours a day, rotating so slowly it made only 2 full turns an hour, sometimes less. For Guy, the rotation was crucial. He believed that culture medium needed to be in constant motion, like blood and fluids in the body, which flow around cells, transporting waste and nutrients. When Mary finally finished cutting the samples of Henrietta's cervix and dropping them in dozens of roller tubes, she walked into the incubator room, slid the tubes one at a time into the drum, and turned it on. Then she watched as Guy's machine began churning slowly. Henrietta spent the next 2 days in the hospital, recovering from her first radium treatment. Doctors examined her inside and out, pressing on her stomach, inserting new catheters into her bladder, fingers into her vagina and anus, needles into her veins. They wrote notes in her chart saying, 30-year-old colored female lying quietly in no evident distress, and patient feels quite well tonight. Morale is good and she is ready to go home. Before Henrietta left the hospital, a doctor put her feet in the stirrups again and removed the radium. He sent her home with instructions to call the clinic if she had problems and to come back for a second dose of radium in 2.5 weeks. Meanwhile, each morning after putting Henrietta's cells in culture, Mary started her days with the usual sterilization drill. She peered into the tubes, laughing to herself and thinking, "Nothing's happening. Big surprise." Then, 2 days after Henrietta went home from the hospital, Mary saw what looked like little rings of fried egg white around the clots at the bottoms of each tube. The cells were growing, but Mary didn't think much of it. Other cells had survived for a while in the lab. But Henrietta's cells weren't merely surviving. They were growing with mythological intensity. By the next morning, they doubled. Mary divided the contents of each tube into two, giving them room to grow. And within 24 hours, they doubled again. Soon she was dividing them into four tubes, then six. Henrietta's cells grew to fill as much space as Mary gave them. Still, Guy wasn't ready to celebrate. The cells could die any minute, he told Mary. But they didn't. They kept growing like nothing anyone had seen, doubling their numbers every 24 hours, stacking hundreds on top of hundreds, accumulating by the millions. Spreading like crabgrass, Margaret said. They grew 20 times faster than Henrietta's normal cells, which died only a few days after Mary put them in culture. As long as they had food and warmth, Henrietta's cancer cells seemed unstoppable. Soon, George told a few of his closest colleagues that he thought his lab might have grown the first immortal human cells, to which they replied, "Can I have some?" And George said yes. Chapter 5 Blackness be spreadin' all inside. 1951. Henrietta knew nothing about her cells growing in a laboratory. After leaving the hospital, she went back to life as usual. She'd never loved the city, so almost every weekend she took the children back to Clover, where she worked the tobacco fields and spent hours churning butter on the steps of the home house. Though radium often causes relentless nausea, vomiting, weakness, and anemia, there's no record of Henrietta having any side effects, and no one remembers her complaining of feeling sick. When she wasn't in Clover, Henrietta spent her time cooking for Day, the children, and whichever cousins happened to be at her house. She made her famous rice pudding and slow-cooked greens, chitlins, and the vats of spaghetti with meatballs she kept going on the stove for whenever cousins dropped by hungry. When Day wasn't working the night shift, he and Henrietta spent evenings at home, playing cards and listening to Benny Smith play blues guitar on the radio after the kids went to sleep. On the nights Day worked, Henrietta and Sadie would wait until the door slammed, count to 100, then jump out of bed, put on their dancing clothes, and sneak out of the house, careful not to wake the children. Once they got outside, they'd wiggle their hips and squeal, scampering down the street to the dance floors at Adams Bar and Twin Pines. "We used to really swing out heavy," Sadie told me years later. "We couldn't help it. They played music that when you heard it just put your soul into it. We'd two-step across that floor, jiggle to some blues, then somebody maybe put a quarter in there and play a slow music song, and Lord, we just get out there and shake and turn around and all like that." She giggled like a young girl. It was some beautiful times. And they were beautiful women. Henrietta had walnut eyes, straight white teeth, and full lips. She was a sturdy woman with a square jaw, thick hips, short, muscular legs, and hands rough from tobacco fields and kitchens. She kept her nails short so bread dough wouldn't stick under them when she needed it. But she always painted them a deep red to match her toenails. Henrietta spent hours taking care of those nails, touching up chips and brushing on new coats of polish. She'd sit on her bed, polish in hand, hair high on her head in curlers, wearing the silky slip she loved so much she hand-washed it each night. She never wore pants, and rarely left the house without pulling on a carefully pressed skirt and shirt, sliding her feet into her tiny open-toed pumps, and pinning her hair up with a little flip at the bottom. just like it was dancing toward her face, Sadie always said. Henny made life come alive. Being with her was like being with fun, Sadie told me, staring toward the ceiling as she talked. Henny just loved peoples. She was a person that could really make the good things come out of you. But there was one person Henrietta couldn't bring out any good in. Ethel, the wife of their cousin, Galen, had recently come to Turner Station from Clover, and she hated Henrietta. Her cousins always said it was jealousy. I guess I can't say as I blame her, Sadie said. Galen, that husband of Ethel's, he was liking Henny more than he liked Ethel. Lord, he followed Henny. Everywhere she'd go, there go Galen. He tried to stay up at Henny house all the time when day gone to work. Lord, Ethel was jealous. Made her hateful to Henny something fierce. Always seemed like she wanted to hurt Henny. So Henrietta and Sadie would giggle and slip out the back to another club any time Ethel showed up. When they weren't sneaking out, Henrietta, Sadie, and Sadie's sister Margaret spent evenings in Henrietta's living room, playing bingo, yelling, and laughing over a pot of pennies, while Henrietta's babies, David Jr., Deborah, and Joe, played with the bingo chips on the carpet beneath the table. Lawrence was nearly 16, already out having a life of his own. But one child was missing, Henrietta's oldest daughter, Elsie. Before Henrietta got sick, she took Elsie down to Clover every time she went. Elsie would sit on the stoop of the home house, staring into the hills and watching the sun rise as Henrietta worked in the garden. She was beautiful, delicate and feminine like Henrietta, who dressed her in homemade outfits with bows and spent hours braiding her long brown curls. Elsie never talked. She just cawed and chirped like a bird as she waved her hands inches from her face. She had wide chestnut eyes that everyone stared into, trying to understand what went on in that pretty head. But she just stared back, unflinching, her eyes haunted with fear and sadness that only softened when Henrietta rocked her back and forth. Sometimes Elsie raced through the fields, chasing wild turkeys or grabbing the family mule by the tail and thrashing against him until Lawrence pulled her off. Henrietta's cousin Peter always said God had that child from the moment she was born because that mule never hurt her. It was so mean it snapped at air like a rabid dog and kicked at the wind, but it seemed to know Elsie was special. Still, as she grew, she fell, she ran into walls and doors, burned herself against the wood stove. Henrietta made Day drive her and Elsie to revival meetings so preachers and tents could lay hands on Elsie to heal her. But it never worked. In Turner Station, sometimes Elsie bolted from the house and ran through the street screaming. By the time Henrietta got pregnant with baby Joe, Elsie was too big for Henrietta to handle alone, especially with two babies. The doctor said that sending Elsie away was the best thing. So now, she was living about an hour and a half south of Baltimore at Crownsville State Hospital, formerly known as the Hospital for the Negro Insane. Henrietta's cousins always said a bit of Henrietta died the day they sent Elsie away, that losing her was worse than anything else that happened to her. Now, nearly a year later, Henrietta still had Day or a cousin take her from Turner Station to Crownsville once a week to sit with Elsie, who'd cry and cling to her as they played with each other's hair. Henrietta had a way with children. They were always good and quiet when she was around. But whenever she left the house, Lawrence stopped being good. If the weather was nice, he'd run to the old pier in Turner Station, where Henrietta had forbidden him to go. The pier had burned down years earlier, leaving tall wooden pilings that Lawrence and his friends liked to dive from. One of Sadie's sons nearly drowned out there from hitting his head on a rock, and Lawrence was always coming home with eye infections that everyone blamed on the water being contaminated by Sparrow's Point. Anytime Henrietta got word that Lawrence was at the pier, she'd storm down there, drag him out of the water, and whip him. "Ooh, Lord," Sadie said once. "And he went down there with a switch. Yes, Lord, she pitched a boogie like I never seen." But those were the only times anyone could ever remember seeing Henrietta mad. "She was tough," Sadie said. "Nothing scared Henny." For a month and a half, no one in Turner Station knew Henrietta was sick. The cancer was easy to keep secret, because she only had to go back to Hopkins once for a checkup and a second radium treatment. At that point, the doctors liked what they saw. Her cervix was a bit red and inflamed from the first treatment, but the tumor was shrinking. Regardless, she had to start X-ray therapy, which meant visiting Hopkins every weekday for a month. For that, she needed help. Henrietta lived 20 minutes from Hopkins, and Day worked nights, so he couldn't take her home after radiation until late. She wanted to walk to her cousin Margaret's house a few blocks from Hopkins and wait there for Day after her treatments. But first, she'd have to tell Margaret and Sadie she was sick. Henrietta told her cousins about the cancer at a carnival that came to Turner Station each year. The three of them climbed onto the Ferris wheel as usual, and she waited till it got so high they could see across Sparrow's Point toward the ocean, till the Ferris wheel stopped and they were just kicking their legs back and forth, swinging in the crisp spring air. "You remember when I said I had a knot inside me?" she asked. They nodded yes. "Well, I got cancer," Henrietta said. "I've been having treatments down at John Hopkins."
"What?"
Sadie said, looking at Henrietta and feeling suddenly dizzy, like she was about to slide off the Ferris wheel.
"Nothing serious wrong with me," Henrietta said. "I'm fine."
And at that point, it looked like she was right. The tumor had completely vanished from the radium treatments. As far as the doctors could see, Henrietta's cervix was normal again, and they felt no tumors anywhere else. Her doctors were so sure of her recovery that while she was in the hospital for her second radium treatment, they'd performed reconstructive surgery on her nose, fixing the deviated septum that had given her sinus infections and headaches her whole life. It was a new beginning. The radiation treatments were just to make sure there were no cancer cells left anywhere inside her. But about 2 weeks after her second radium treatment, Henrietta got her period. The flow was heavy, and it didn't stop. She was still bleeding weeks later on March 20th, when Day began dropping her off each morning at Hopkins for her radiation treatments. She'd change into a surgical gown, lie on an exam table with an enormous machine mounted on the wall above her, and a doctor would put strips of lead inside her vagina to protect her colon and lower spine from the radiation. On the first day, he tattooed two black dots with temporary ink on either side of her abdomen, just over her uterus. They were targets, so he could aim the radiation into the same area each day, but rotate between spots to avoid burning her skin too much in one place. After each treatment, Henrietta would change back into her clothes and walk the few blocks to Margaret's house, where she'd wait for Day to pick her up around midnight. For the first week or so, she and Margaret would sit on the porch playing cards or bingo, talking about the men, the cousins, and the children. At that point, the radiation seemed like nothing more than an inconvenience. Henrietta's bleeding stopped, and if she felt sick from the treatments, she never mentioned it. But things weren't all good.
Toward the end of her treatments, Henrietta asked her doctor when she'd be better so she could have another child. Until that moment, Henrietta didn't know that the treatments had left her infertile. Warning patients about fertility loss before cancer treatment was standard practice at Hopkins, and something Howard Jones says he and Talin did with every patient. In fact, a year and a half before Henrietta came to Hopkins for treatment, in a paper about hysterectomy, Talin wrote, "The psychic effect of hysterectomy, especially on the young, is considerable, and it should not be done without a thorough understanding on the part of the patient, who is entitled to a simple explanation of the facts, including loss of the reproductive function. It is well to present the facts to such an individual and give her ample time to digest them. It is far better for her to make her own adjustment before the operation than to awaken from the anesthetic and find it a fait accompli." In this case, something went wrong. In Henrietta's medical record, one of her doctors wrote, "Told she could not have any more children. Says if she had been told so before, she would not have gone through with treatment." But by the time she found out, it was too late. Then, 3 weeks after starting X-ray therapy, she began burning inside, and her urine came out feeling like broken glass. Day said he'd been having a funny discharge, and that she must have given him that sickness she kept going to Hopkins to treat. "I would rather imagine that it is the other way around," Jones wrote in Henrietta's chart after examining her. "But at any rate, this patient now has acute gonorrhea superimposed on radiation reaction." Soon, however, Day's running around was the least of Henrietta's worries. That short walk to Margaret started feeling longer and longer, and all Henrietta wanted to do when she got there was sleep. One day she almost collapsed a few blocks from Hopkins, and it took her nearly an hour to make the walk. After that, she started taking cabs. One afternoon, as Henrietta lay on the couch, she lifted her shirt to show Margaret and Sadie what the treatments had done to her. Sadie gasped. The skin from Henrietta's breasts to her pelvis was charred a deep black from the radiation. The rest of her body was its natural shade, more the color of fawn than coal. "Annie," she whispered, "they burnt you black as tar." Henrietta just nodded and said, "Lord, it just feels like that blackness be spreading all inside me." Chapter 6. Ladies on the Phone, 1999. 11 years after learning about Henrietta in Deffler's classroom, on my 27th birthday, I stumbled on a collection of scientific papers from something called the HeLa Cancer Control Symposium at Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta, one of the oldest historically black colleges in the country. The symposium had been organized in Henrietta's honor by Roland Patillo, a professor of gynecology at Morehouse, who'd been one of George Guy's only African-American students. When I called Roland Patillo to see what he knew about Henrietta, I told him I was writing a book about her. "Oh, you are," he said, laughing a slow, rumbling laugh that said, "Oh, child, you have no idea what you're getting into. Henrietta's family won't talk to you. They've had a terrible time with the HeLa cells." "You know her family?" I said. "Can you put me in touch with them?" "I do have the ability to put you in touch with them, but you need to answer a few questions, starting with, why should I?" For the next hour, Patillo grilled me about my intentions. As I told him about the history of my HeLa obsession, he grumbled and sighed, letting out occasional mmms and wells. Eventually, he said, "Correct me if I'm wrong, but you are white.
Is it that obvious?
Yes, he said. What do you know about African Americans and science?
I told him about the Tuskegee syphilis study, like I was giving an oral report in history class. It started in the 30s, when the U.S. Department of Public Health researchers at the Tuskegee Institute decided to study how syphilis killed, from infection to death. They recruited hundreds of African American men with syphilis, then watched them die slow, painful, and preventable deaths, even after they realized penicillin could cure them. The research subjects didn't ask questions. They were poor and uneducated, and the researchers offered incentives, free physical exams, hot meals, and rides into town on clinic days, plus $50 burial stipends for their families when the men died. The researchers chose black subjects because they, like many whites at the time, believed black people were a notoriously syphilis-soaked race. The public didn't learn about the Tuskegee study until the 70s, after hundreds of men enrolled in it had already died. The news spread like pox through black communities. Doctors were doing research on black people, lying to them and watching them die. Rumors started circulating that the doctors had actually injected the men with syphilis in order to study them.
What else? Patillo grumbled.
I told him I'd heard about so-called Mississippi appendectomies, unnecessary hysterectomies performed on poor black women to stop them from reproducing, and to give young doctors a chance to practice the procedure. I'd also read about the lack of funding for research into sickle cell anemia, a disease that affected blacks almost exclusively.
It's interesting that you called when you did, he said. I'm organizing the next HeLa conference. And when the phone rang, I just sat down at my desk and typed the words Henrietta Lacks on my screen.
We both laughed. It must be a sign, we said. Perhaps Henrietta wanted us to talk.
Deborah is Henrietta's baby girl, he said, very matter of fact. The family calls her Dale. She's almost 50 now, still living in Baltimore, with grandchildren of her own. Henrietta's husband is still alive. He's around 84. Still goes to the clinics at Johns Hopkins.
He dropped this like a tease.
Did you know Henrietta had an epileptic daughter? Patillo asked.
No.
She died at 15, soon after Henrietta's death. Deborah is the only daughter left, he said. She came near a stroke recently because of the agony she's gone through regarding inquiries into her mother's death and those cells. I won't be a part of anyone doing that to her again.
I started to speak, but he interrupted me.
I need to go see patients now, he said abruptly. I'm not ready to put you in touch with the family yet. But I think you're honest about your intentions. We will talk again after I think. Call back tomorrow.
After 3 straight days of grilling, Patillo finally decided to give me Deborah's phone number. But first, he said, there were a few things I needed to know. He lowered his voice and rattled off a list of do's and don'ts for dealing with Deborah Lacks. Don't be aggressive. Do be honest. Don't be clinical. Don't try to force her into anything. Don't talk down to her. She hates that. Do be compassionate. Don't forget that she's been through a lot with these cells. Do have patience.
You'll need that more than anything, he told me.
Moments after hanging up the phone with Patillo, his list of do's and don'ts in my hand, I dialed Deborah's number, then paced as her phone rang. When she whispered hello, I blurted out, I'm so excited you answered because I've been wanting to talk to you for years. I'm writing a book about your mother.
Huh?
She said. I didn't know that Deborah was nearly deaf. She relied heavily on lip reading and couldn't follow anyone who talked fast. I took a deep breath and tried again, forcing myself to sound out every syllable.
Hi. My name is Rebecca.
How you doing? She said, weary but warm. I'm very excited to talk to you.
Mm-hmm, she said, like she'd heard that line many times before.
I told her again that I wanted to write a book about her mother and said I was surprised no one seemed to know anything about her, even though her cells were so important for science. Deborah sat silent for a long moment, then screamed,
"That's right!"
She giggled and started talking like we'd known each other for years.
"Everything always just about the cells, and don't even worry about her name and was Hela even a person. So hallelujah! I think a book would be great."
This was not what I'd expected. I was afraid to say anything that might make her stop talking, so I simply said, "Great." And that was the last word I spoke until the end of our call. I didn't ask a single question, just took notes as fast as I could. Deborah crammed a lifetime of information into a manic and confusing 45 minutes that jumped without warning and in no particular order from the 1920s to the 1990s, from stories of her father to her grandfather, cousins, mother, and total strangers.
"Nobody never said nothing," she told me. "I mean, where my mother's clothes at? Where my mother's shoes? I knew about her watch and ring, but it was stolen. That was after my brother killed that boy."
She talked about a man she didn't name, saying,
"I didn't think it was fit for him to steal my mother's medical record and autopsy papers. He was in prison for 15 years in Alabama. Now he's saying John Hopkins killed my mother and them white doctors experimented on her 'cause she was black." "My nerve broke down," she said. "I just couldn't take it. My speech is coming back a little better. I almost had 2 strokes in 2 weeks because of all that stuff with my mother's cells."
Then, suddenly, she was talking about her family history, saying something about
the hospital for crazy Negroes
and her mother's great-grandfather having been a slave owner.
"We all mixed. And one of my mother's sisters converted to Puerto Rican."
Again and again, she said,
"I can't take it anymore." And, "Who are we supposed to trust now?"
More than anything, she told me, she wanted to learn about her mother and what her cells had done for science. She said people had been promising her information for decades and never delivering it.
"I'm sick of it," she said.
"You know what I really want? I want to know, what did my mother smell like? For all my life, I just don't know anything. Not even the little common little things, like what color she like. Did she like to dance? Did she breastfeed me? Lord, I'd like to know that. But nobody ever say nothing."
She laughed and said, "I tell you one thing, the story's not over yet. You got your work cut out for you, girl. This thing's crazy enough for 3 books.
Then someone walked through her front door and Deborah yelled straight into the receiver,
"Good morning. I got mail."
She sounded panicked by the idea of it.
"Oh, my God. Oh, no. Mail?" "Okay, Miss Rebecca," she said. "I got to go. You call me Monday, promise?" "Okay, dear. God bless. Bye-bye."
She hung up, and I sat stunned, receiver crooked in my neck, frantically scribbling notes I didn't understand, like, brother equals murder. Mail equals bad. Man stole Henrietta's medical records. And hospital for Negro insane? When I called Deborah back as promised, she sounded like a different person. Her voice was monotone, depressed, and slurred, like she was heavily sedated.
"No interviews,"
she mumbled almost incoherently.
"You got to go away. My brothers say I should write my own book, but I ain't a writer. I'm sorry." I tried to speak, but she cut me off. I can't talk to you no more. Only thing to do is convince the man.
She gave me 3 phone numbers, her father, her oldest brother Lawrence, and her brother David Jr.'s pager.
Everybody call him Sonny,
she told me, then hung up. I wouldn't hear her voice again for nearly a year. I started calling Deborah, her brothers, and her father daily, but they didn't answer. Finally, after several days of leaving messages, someone answered at Day's house. A young boy who didn't say hello just breathed into the receiver, hip-hop thumping in the background. When I asked for David, the boy said,
"Yeah,"
and threw the phone down.
"Go get Pop,"
he yelled, followed by a long pause.
"It's important. Get Pop."
No response.
"Lady's on the phone," he yelled. "Come on."
The first boy breathed into the receiver again as a second boy picked up an extension and said hello.
"Hi," I said. "Can I talk to David?"
"Who this?"
he asked. "Rebecca," I said. He moved the phone away from his mouth and yelled,
"Get Pop! Lady's on the phone about his wife's cells."
Years later, I'd understand how a young boy could know why I was calling just from the sound of my voice. The only time white people called Day was when they wanted something having to do with HeLa cells. But at the time, I was confused. I figured I must have heard wrong. A woman picked up a receiver, saying,
"Hello, may I help you?"
She was sharp, curt, like, "I do not have time for this." I told her I was hoping to talk to David, and she asked who was calling. "Rebecca," I said, afraid she'd hang up if I said anything more.
"Just a moment."
She sighed and lowered the phone.
"Go take this to Day," she told the child. "Tell him he got a long-distance call. Somebody named Rebecca calling about his wife's cells."
The child grabbed the phone, pressed it to his ear, and ran for Day. Then there was a long silence.
"Pop, get up," the kid whispered. "There's somebody about your wife."
"What?"
"Get up. There's somebody about your wife's cells."
"What? Where?"
"Wife's cells. On the phone. Get up."
"Where are her cells?"
"Here,"
the boy said, handing Day the phone.
"Yeah."
"Hi, is this David Lax?"
"Yeah."
I told him my name and started to explain why I was calling, but before I could say much, he let out a deep sigh.
"What now this?"
he mumbled in a deep southern accent, his words slurred like he'd had a stroke.
"You got my wife's cells?"
"Yeah," I said, thinking he was asking if I was calling about his wife's cells.
"Yeah,"
he said, suddenly bright, alert.
"You got my wife's cells. She know you talking?"
"Yeah," I said, thinking he was asking if Deborah knew I was calling.
"Well, so let my old lady's cells talk to you and leave me alone,"
he snapped.
"I had enough of you people."
Then he hung up. Chapter 7. The Death and Life of Cell Culture, 1951. On April 10, 1951, 3 weeks after Henrietta started radiation therapy, George Guy appeared on WAAM television in Baltimore for a special show devoted to his work. With dramatic music in the background, the announcer said, "Tonight, we will learn why scientists believe that cancer can be conquered." The camera flashed to Guy, sitting at a desk in front of a wall covered with pictures of cells. His face was long and handsome, with a pointed nose, black plastic bifocals, and a Charlie Chaplin mustache. He sat stiff and straight-backed, tweed suit perfectly pressed, white handkerchief in his breast pocket, hair slicked. His eyes darted off-screen, then back to the camera as he drummed his fingers on the desk, his face expressionless.
The normal cells which make up our bodies are tiny objects, 5,000 of which would fit on the head of a pin, he said, his voice a bit too loud and stilted. How the normal cells become cancerous is still a mystery.
He gave viewers a basic overview of cell structure and cancer using diagrams and a long wooden pointer. He showed films of cells moving across the screen, their edges inching further and further into the empty space around them. And he zoomed in on one cancer cell, its edges round and smooth until it began to quiver and shake violently, exploding into 5 cancer cells. At one point, he said, "Now let me show you a bottle in which we have grown massive quantities of cancer cells." He picked up a clear glass pint-sized bottle, most likely full of Henrietta's cells, and rocked it in his hands as he explained that his lab was using those cells to find ways to stop cancer. He said, "It is quite possible that from fundamental studies such as these, that we will be able to learn a way by which cancer cells can be damaged or completely wiped out." To help make that happen, Guy began sending Henrietta's cells to any scientist who might use them for cancer research. Shipping live cells in the mail, a common practice today, wasn't done at the time. Instead, Guy sent them via planes in tubes with a few drops of culture medium, just enough to keep them alive for a short time. Sometimes pilots or stewards tucked the tubes into their shirt pockets to keep the cells at body temperature as if they were still in an incubator. Other times, when the cells had to ride in the cargo hold, Guy tucked them into holes carved in blocks of ice to keep them from overheating, then packed the ice in cardboard boxes filled with sawdust. When shipments were ready to go, Guy would warn recipients that the cells were about to metastasize to their cities
so they could stand ready to fetch the shipment and rush back to their labs. If all went well, the cells survived. If not, Guy packaged up another batch and tried again.
He sent shipments of HeLa cells to researchers in Texas, India, New York, Amsterdam, and many places between. Those researchers gave them to more researchers, who gave them to more still. Henrietta's cells rode into the mountains of Chile in the saddlebags of pack mules. As Guy flew from one lab to another, demonstrating his culturing techniques and helping to set up new laboratories, he always flew with tubes of Henrietta's cells in his breast pocket. And when scientists visited Guy's lab to learn his techniques, he usually sent them home with a vial or two of HeLa. In letters, Guy and some of his colleagues began referring to the cells as his precious babies. The reason Henrietta's cells were so precious was because they allowed them to perform experiments that would have been impossible with a living human. They cut HeLa cells apart and exposed them to endless toxins, radiation, and infections. They bombarded them with drugs, hoping to find one that would kill malignant cells without destroying normal ones. They studied immune suppression and cancer growth by injecting HeLa cells into immune-compromised rats, which developed malignant tumors much like Henrietta's. If the cells died in the process, it didn't matter. Scientists could just go back to their eternally growing HeLa stock and start over again. Despite the spread of HeLa and the flurry of new research that followed, there were no news stories about the birth of the amazing HeLa cell line and how it might help stop cancer. In Guy's one appearance on television, he didn't mention Henrietta or her cells by name, so the general public knew nothing of HeLa. But even if they had known, they probably wouldn't have paid it much mind. For decades, the press had been reporting that cell culture was going to save the world from disease and make man immortal. But by 1951, the general public had stopped buying it. Cell culture had become less a medical miracle
then something out of a scary science fiction movie. It all started on January 17, 1912, when Alexis Carrel, a French surgeon at the Rockefeller Institute, grew his immortal chicken heart. Scientists had been trying to grow living cells since before the turn of the century, but their samples had always died. As a result, many researchers believed it was impossible to keep tissues alive outside the body. But Carrel set out to prove them wrong. At age 39, he'd already invented the first technique for suturing blood vessels together, and had used it to perform the first coronary bypass and develop methods for transplanting organs. He hoped someday to grow whole organs in the laboratory, filling massive vaults with lungs, livers, kidneys, and tissues he could ship through the mail for transplantation. As a first step, he'd tried to grow a sliver of chicken heart tissue in culture. And to everyone's amazement, it worked. Those heart cells kept beating as if they were still in the chicken's body. Months later, Carrel won a Nobel Prize for his blood vessel suturing technique and his contributions to organ transplantation, and he became an instant celebrity. The prize had nothing to do with the chicken heart, but articles about his award conflated the immortal chicken heart cells with his transplantation work, and suddenly it sounded like he'd found the fountain of youth. Headlines around the world read, "Carrel's new miracle points way to avert old age. Scientists grow immortal chicken heart. Death, perhaps not inevitable." Scientists said Carrel's chicken heart cells were one of the most important advances of the century, and that cell culture would uncover the secrets behind everything from eating and sex to the music of Bach, the poems of Milton, and the genius of Michelangelo. Carrel was a scientific messiah. Magazines called his culture medium an elixir of youth and claimed that bathing in it might make a person live forever. But Carrel wasn't interested in immortality for the masses. He was a eugenicist. Organ transplantation and life extension were ways to preserve what he saw as the superior white race, which he believed was being polluted by less intelligent and inferior stock, namely the poor, uneducated, and non-white. He dreamed of never-ending life for those he deemed worthy, and death or forced sterilization for everyone else. He'd later praise Hitler for the energetic measures he took in that direction. Carrel's eccentricities fed into the media frenzy about his work. He was a stout, fast-talking Frenchman with mismatched eyes, one brown, the other blue, who rarely went out without his surgeon's cap. He wrongly believed that light could kill cell cultures, so his laboratory looked like the photo negative of a Ku Klux Klan rally, where technicians worked in long black robes, heads covered in black hoods with small slits cut for their eyes. They sat on black stools at black tables in a shadowless room with floors, ceilings, and walls painted black. The only illumination came from a small, dust-covered skylight. Carrel was a mystic who believed in telepathy and clairvoyance, and thought it was possible for humans to live several centuries through the use of suspended animation. Eventually, he turned his apartment into a chapel, began giving lectures on medical miracles, and told reporters he dreamed of moving to South America and becoming a dictator. Other researchers distanced themselves, criticizing him for being unscientific. But much of white America embraced his ideas and saw him as a spiritual advisor and a genius. Reader's Digest ran articles by Carrel advising women that a husband should not be induced by an oversexed wife to perform a sexual act, since sex drained the mind. In his best-selling book, Man the Unknown, he proposed fixing what he believed was an error in the U.S. Constitution that promised equality for all people. "The feeble-minded and the man of genius should not be equal before the law," he wrote. "The stupid,
the unintelligent, those who are dispersed, incapable of attention, of effort, have no right to a higher education. His book sold more than 2 million copies and was translated into 20 languages.
Thousands showed up for Carell's talks,
sometimes requiring police in riot gear to keep order as buildings filled to capacity and fans had to be turned away.
Through all of this, the press and public remained obsessed with Carell's immortal chicken heart. Each year on New Year's Day, the New York World Telegram called Carell to check on the cells, and every January 17th for decades, when Carell and his assistants lined up in their black suits to sing Happy Birthday to the cells, some newspaper or magazine retold the same story again and again.
Chicken heart cells alive 10 years, 14 years, 20. Each time, the stories promised the cells would change the face of medicine. But they never did. Meanwhile, Carell's claims about the cells grew more fantastical. At one point, he said, the cells would reach a volume greater than that of the solar system. The Literary Digest reported that the cells could have already covered the Earth, and a British tabloid said they could form a rooster big enough today to cross the Atlantic in a single stride, a bird so monstrous that when perched on this mundane sphere, the world, it would look like a weathercock. A string of best-selling books warned of the dangers of tissue culture. One predicted that 70% of babies would soon be grown in culture. Another imagined tissue culture producing giant Negroes and two-headed toads. But the fear of tissue culture truly found its way into American living rooms in an episode of Lights Out, a 1930s radio horror show that told the story of a fictional Dr. Alberts who'd created an immortal chicken heart in his lab. It grew out of control, filling the city streets like the Blob, consuming everyone and everything in its path. In only 2 weeks, it destroyed the entire country. The real chicken heart cells didn't fare so well. In fact, it turned out that the original cells had probably never survived long at all.
Years after Carell died, awaiting trial for collaborating with the Nazis, scientist Leonard Hayflick grew suspicious of the chicken heart. No one had ever been able to replicate Carell's work, and the cells seemed to defy a basic rule of biology, that normal cells can only divide a finite number of times before dying. Hayflick investigated them and concluded that the original chicken heart cells had actually died soon after Carell put them in culture, and that, intentionally or not, Carell had been putting new cells in the culture dishes each time he fed them using an embryo juice he made from ground tissues. At least one of Carell's former lab assistants verified Hayflick's suspicion.